You are listening to the Global Security Podcast from Johns Hopkins University's Krieger School of Arts and Sciences, Advanced Academic Programs in Washington, D.C. We're fortunate today to have with us Dr. Meir Elron. He's a senior research fellow and head of the Homeland Security Program and also co-head of the Society and Military Program of the Institute of National Security Studies in Israel. He is not only a doctor, but he is a retired brigadier general, having served for 24 years in the Israeli Defense Forces, primarily in the Military Intelligence Directorate. And his last post with the IDF was as Deputy Director of Military Intelligence, a job he had from 1987 to 1989. Following his retirement from the military, Brigadier General Dr. Elron, or is it Dr. Brigadier General? Which one comes first?
In Israel, the general comes first.
All right. Brigadier General Dr. Elron served as Chief of Staff of the Tel Aviv Municipality, and later he was a senior consultant for a variety of offices in the Israeli government, including the Defense Ministry, the Ministry of Education, the Ministry of Internal Security, and also the National Security Council. In his academic career now, his main areas of interest are homeland security, disaster management, and societal resilience in the face of terrorism, which will be our main topic today. Dr. Elron holds a bachelor's degree from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem in political science and Middle East studies, a master's degree from Indiana University here in the States in international relations and Russian studies, and a brand new this year PhD in political science from the Haifa University, where I understand you wrote on societal resilience in Israel. So congratulations on your...
Thank you very much.
I know that's a long, hard slog. I've done it myself.
Interesting.
My hat is off to you. So thank you very much for sitting down with us. So you're an expert and have been working for some time now in this field of societal resilience, which is a term I think a lot of our audience has probably heard but may not know a whole lot about. So just if you want to start at the just very basic level and tell us, what is societal resilience?
Okay, societal resilience is part of a whole family of resilience. Okay, so we start with what resilience is and then say something about societal resilience. Resilience is defined by me as the capacity of a system, any system, to stand up against disruptions, major disruptions, which usually bring about a degradation of the functionality of the affected system, and then bounce back after a while, a short or longer while, to a level that either corresponds with the initial level of functionality of the system, or possibly, hopefully, bouncing forward to a higher level of functionality.
And we'll talk more about that a little bit later. So just so I understand you before you go into societal then, so at that level, so the concept of resilience, correct if I'm wrong here, could apply to political systems, economic systems, biological systems, to military units, to a broad range of things, right?
It applies to all systems from the human being to the nation and universe, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
Both socially, economically, infrastructure, military, what have you. Any system that can be defined as a system, as an operating system, which has a core functionality, would be subject to being resilient or not resilient.
Okay. So what about societal resilience specifically, then?
Okay, societal resilience, of course, deals with society, with communities, with small communities, large communities, groups of people, okay? And it is basically, as anybody can understand, a very complex issue because it deals with people. There is nothing more complex with people than as an association of people. One person is bad enough, but when you talk about a group of people, an interaction between people within a set of whatever, values, organization, etc., we would call it a societal issue or societal resilience in this respect.
So is there a difference between this and civil defense?
Absolutely. Okay. It's not, we have to understand it, it's a very broad concept. It has to do with disruptions, as I said. The context of resilience is being manifested only when we have a disruption, usually a severe disruption. But the disruption can be either natural or man-made. As a matter of fact, most of the disruptions and the more devastating disruptions in our world, of course, would be natural disasters. Only a fraction of the disasters that we are facing, notably the most spoken about and, you know, feared about, are the man-made disruptions. But the more costly ones, the more damaging one, of course, are natural disasters. So we are speaking about different kinds of a very large gamut of disruptions. And actually what we do is we take the concept of all-hazard approach to disasters.
What does that mean?
Which means that it is not really important what are the roots of a certain disruption. Mostly it's important for us what are the consequences of the disruption. So we want to know what the consequences are in order to do something about those consequences. Because, and this is very important for us to understand, in most cases we can do little about the disruption itself. What we can do a lot about is the consequences, or are the consequences of the disruption. And here comes the issue of resilience.
Okay. So we're talking potentially anything from society bouncing back or bouncing forward, as you say, from hurricanes and earthquakes,
exactly,
to terrorism,
exactly,
war, cyber attacks?
Absolutely. Or, you know, if you have a company or a bank or an economic project, you can also, you know, hit a major disruption. And the big question is what you do about the consequences of that. So if you're a resilient system, of course, you will bounce back faster to a higher level. And if you're not, you can lose your project. You can lose your company, or you can actually stop being a project or a system. This can also happen to you. So this issue of resilience is a overarching kind of a concept that actually deals with all aspects of life as long as it's human. Of course, there is also another issue which is interesting, which is the environment itself, because some people speak about the ecosystem, the universal ecosystem. Here again, you have an issue of disruptive components or disruptive processes. And so the question is, what happens to the environment? Would it sustain itself? Would it be transformative? Would it be resilient? Okay, big question. And then, of course, it takes also into account the relationship, very complicated relationship between the human race and the environment at large. So all those things are related one way or another with the issue of resilience. Of course, yeah. So it's so broad. I picked up a very narrow part of it, which is societal resilience under circumstances of terror.
Okay, so let's focus on that then. Societal resilience under circumstances of terror, and unfortunately Israel has a great deal of experience
That's
with terrorism.
Correct, yeah.
How then can this societal resilience be measured? Or put another way, how can you tell if a country has got it or doesn't, or the degree to which they have it?
Okay, one thing before I answer this one, and if I forgot to answer you.
Okay, I'll
please,
come back. I'll keep you honest.
Bring me back to, on track. I perceive resilience not just as a philosophy or an approach, but also as a strategy.
Okay.
And especially when it comes to terrorism, and this is my field, as we said, most nations around the world would respond to terrorism by the strategy of resistance. This is what people do all the time. They try to resist terrorism. Okay,
resist in the sense of, say, capture or kill the terrorists, or
not
thwart
that,
their plans before
make
they
it end. Not happen.
You know, make it not happen. Okay.
Okay.
Good.
If you
right.
can do that, or if you cannot do that, delay it, postpone it, and if you cannot do that, mitigate its consequences, or protect yourself from it in different ways. But basically, this is the default strategy that people throughout years, always, okay, everywhere, have been taking. My suggestion is, and this is an important point that I wanted to make, my suggestion is that, number one, resistance is very important. Everybody does resistance. But the other problem is, you have to take into consideration that resistance is not a 100% foolproof kind of a strategy.
Sure.
You have to understand that if you What we usually do, we build walls against around us. That's what we do. This is based on the cave syndrome that people have been developed since early days. But people usually put a lot of money, lots of investments on resistance measures of different kinds. They build different kinds of walls around them. Walls can be actual walls, or it can be the Iron Dome, for example, is a wall, etc., etc. Okay, not only against terrorists, by the way, against tsunamis, against, you know, the ocean coming on after you. Okay, that's what people do. They build walls. But they do not understand, they do not realize something that is very, very apparent and very basic. And that is that resistance does not work all the time. Because mostly in man-made kind of threats, people who are evil would find ways to penetrate the walls, okay, and get into your cave, okay? And that's a problem, it's a major problem. That's why we need a complementary strategy. So we'll go with the resistance thing, we'll invest a lot of money in resistance, okay? Sometimes it works, many times it works, sometimes it doesn't, but when it doesn't work, because risk has penetrated into your environment, into your system, then you need resilience as a strategy.
So okay. So we'll come back to the measurement thing in a minute. I've not forgotten that, but since you raised this, so in some sense that could almost be seen as fitting into a broader strategy of deterrence by denial. Not only do governments work to stop terrorists from acting, mm-hmm. you know, from doing their thing, but also if you are engaged in a strategy of societal resilience, you work to reduce the amount that it matters that terrorists did their thing, right? That if, to the extent that terrorists are trying to terrorize you or force a population or a government to react, resilience erodes that, like, you know, reduces, dampens those reactions, and so contributes to...
This is really the core of my contention.
So we just tied this to deterrence theory.
Exactly. I'm suggesting basically two things here. Number one is that even though terrorism is a major threat, no doubt about that, we are usually exaggerating about the significance of terror, because as democratic societies, we basically know how to deal with them, okay? And if you look at the history of terror, not very bad. I mean, it's bad enough, but it's not very bad. It's not an existential threat to our societies, not to the America, not to Israel, etc., etc. It's important, okay? But what we want to do is to diminish its consequences, so diminish its effects, okay? And here comes, indeed, as you suggested, here comes resilience. The more resilient your society is, the less terror will be able to terrorize you, or to achieve the psychological effects that the enemy or the adversary or the terrorists are trying to bring on you, so as to demoralize you or to frighten you or to create chaos in your midst in order to achieve their political or strategic needs or demands or wishes, if you wish.
Okay, so let's come back to this question then of measuring it.
Okay,
how do I know it when I've got it?
Okay. First of all, let's make it clear that as far as I'm concerned, the human race is extremely resilient. I mean, people are resilient, otherwise we wouldn't have been here. Generations, I mean, decades, thousands of years of history, the human race has experienced tremendous...
Environmental disasters, the Great Plague, World War II, and the Holocaust, etc.
Etc.
And yet we're here.
We're here. And we're not only here, and this is a very important part of resilience, we're not just here, but we have been thriving. And, I mean, there is no comparison to our situation, even the more unprivileged societies, okay, are much more privileged and much more prosperous than human race has been, let's say, 100 years ago or 500 years ago, etc., etc. So despite of the different challenges, including terrorism, our basic situation is not too bad because we are resilient, okay? Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's go back to this issue that you asked me about, how do you measure resilience? Because we want to be very resilient. We want to be, if we can, resilient to the extent that we will be able, as you suggested before, to deter or to foil the very thought of our adversaries to try to pressure us by terror. Okay, so we want to be very resilient, which is very legitimate, and I like it very much. Okay, so the question is, how do you measure it? So if you remember my definition beforehand, I'm talking about this bounce back ability, as we call it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the question is, has two ways to be answered. Number one is, we want to lessen the effects, the bad effects of the disruption. Okay, so we want our degradation of functionality to be low and short. Okay, number one. Number two, we want our bouncing back to be as swift as possible. Okay, and then to bounce back to as high a level as possible. So we have two elements here to measure. Number one is time from the eruption of the disruption. Number two, the level which we want to reach. Okay, so basically, the swifter we bounce back, the more resilient we are. The higher we bounce back, the more resilient we are. Okay. And that's my methodology of measuring or gauging resilience, okay? It can be, by the way, societal resilience, but also infrastructure resilience, okay? For example, if you have an attack, a terrorist attack, on an airport, okay? Okay. Like you had, for example, in recent times, number one in Brussels, and number two in Istanbul, okay? You saw something that was very interesting. It took the Turks less than 24 hours to resume operations of the international airport, while it took the Belgians almost a week to return to normal functionality of the airport, which means to me, okay, based on what I said before, that the Turks, at least the infrastructure and the management, okay, of this particular system, because it can or cannot relate to the entire Turkish nation. This is a problem by itself. But when you look at the system of airports hit by terror, which was quite similar in terms of its severity, okay, you could see very clearly that the Turks or the Turkish airport authority in Istanbul was 7 times more resilient than the one of the Belgians. And then you start analyzing why this is the case, which will come back later on. But again, if you ask me how you measure it, you measure two things. Number one, you measure the time span from disruption to elevation of or bouncing back, number one. And number two, which level of bouncing back or bouncing forward you reach.
Okay, well, since you put it out there, I was going to get there in a minute, but let's do it now. So why, in your view, was Turkey, at least in this particular instance, more resilient than Belgium? What went into that? And okay, or if you want to broaden that out to maybe the Israeli experience
exactly,
as well.
But, yeah, exactly.
So what goes into this?
Okay, first of all, lots of different things go into
it. I'm sure.
Okay, so, and I don't want to bore you right now. I mean, this is a full course of in one of your future
classes. I'll give you two elements.
Number one, preparedness.
Okay.
The more you are prepared for the eventuality of a disruption, the more resilient you will be, okay? This is very, very basic. Everybody understands that, but not everybody does it, in fact, okay? So preparedness, drills, doctrines, a mechanism of recovery, etc., help you to be more resilient and operate or spring back sooner than the others. This is one very important factor in enhancing resilience. But more than that, and this is something that I want to stress, especially when you talk about societal resilience, usually what we do is that the social capital of the system, okay, its inner connections, its bonding, its bridging, its linkage between the different parts of the community, the stronger, more robust, and more intimate, and more proactive they are, the more resilient will the community or the social system be. And we have seen it not only in Israel, we have seen it very, very clearly in Israel, but we have seen it also in other areas, for example, in Japan, okay, with the tsunami. You could see different communities, by the way, you can examine it by different communities, because different communities manifest different levels of resilience. Different societies also manifest different.
So you're saying within, for instance, that Israel and Japan might have different levels of resilience at the national level, but even within, say, Japan, there may be one area that is more resilient than another.
Absolutely, that's exactly. I mean, you have, in different countries, you have a more enhanced culture of resilience, okay? Even without them knowing that that's what it is. But then when you look beyond the level of a nation to the particular communities, you can see differences. But again, there are some very important lines here in this respect that are common. As I said before, for example, social bondage, okay, connectivity between people, activism, social activism, volunteerism, okay, looking after the other, okay, paid attention to the weaker parts of the society. All those things definitely, clearly indicate and would mean that this particular community or society would be more resilient than the others.
So you've talked about connections between people, and I was looking at the piece you wrote, I believe, for Foreign Affairs recently on this.
Correct, yeah.
And you mentioned in there that one of the reasons that Israel has been relatively successful at creating societal resilience is because, and I'm paraphrasing here, and correct me if I get this wrong, but Israel is a small country where everybody knows everybody. And so you have a lot of these social and personal connections that help enable this. And I'm wondering if I'm accurately characterizing that. Immediately as an American, with there's 330 million of us spread across four time zones, and that's excluding Alaska and Hawaii, how well does that scale up? I mean, Israel's a very small, compact country. We're an enormous, sprawling country. Yeah. Can we do this?
Yes, you can.
Good. I'm very glad to hear that.
Absolutely, you can. There is no doubt in my mind. I'll tell you why. I don't think that it's to be proper for our discussion to look at America as one single unit.
Okay.
Why not look at America as a collection of different states? Okay. Because Iowa is not necessarily like Florida, and New York City or New York State is not necessarily as Texas, right? So let's look at the state level, for example, okay? And here all of a sudden you're not talking about 325 people with different cultures, with different moralities and values, etc., but you're looking at communities. And then again, I would say to you, let's not even look at the state level. Let's talk about the local levels, okay? And once you start talking at the local levels, everything look a little bit more manageable, doesn't it? So then I'd say to you, if you come to me and say, wait a minute, but New York has what, 14 million people in it or so? It's a huge conglomerate.
It's bigger than Israel, isn't it, in that
bigger,
regard?
Much bigger than Israel. So I would say, why look at New York City? Let's look at the boroughs. Let's look at the neighborhoods. Let's try to divide, for the sake of understanding what we want to achieve, the huge system into subsystems. And once you are willing to look at what subsystems, and this is something that is very relevant for us as people. It's less relevant for us that we live in a huge country like America, but it's very relevant to us what happens in our own community, in our own neighborhood. And that's what we have to look at, okay? Our own community, where we can make a difference, okay? And here in our own community, in our own neighborhood, we can make a huge difference, okay? And that's what matters, because we are composed basically based on these communities, okay? This is what makes us what we are. So I would suggest to look at this issue of how to enhance resilience, not necessarily top down, but basically bottom up. It's a project for the neighborhoods. It's not a national project.
So it's about civil society.
Absolutely, exactly. So I'll tell you a story. Yesterday I was visiting FEMA and I met some very senior people there, and we discussed this issue, which I thought was a philosophical question. Okay, how can FEMA, as a national agency, okay, sitting here in Washington on C Street, okay, how can it actually enhance the resilience of the people in Nebraska when something happens there? you know what? It's very, very challenging, very difficult. I'm not sure, I'm not saying that they don't do that, but it's very challenging. So it's even more challenging for a national organization or agency like FEMA, which sits up there in the top of things.
Top of the federal government.
To think about transforming itself from a concept or from a strategy which is top down to a strategy that is bottom up. You can't do that. So we found out something together that is very, very interesting. You have, even in the national level, you have to think of ways and means for the communities themselves to start working on those issues, to start working on enhancing the resilience. And there are lots and lots of ways to do it. I'll give you just one example. Here in America, you have lots and lots of faith-based
organizations.
Yeah. Okay, they're spread all over the place. Many of them do have national leadership, but most of the work is being done in the communities,
individual
in the churches,
and synagogues, and mosques.
Just think about what they can do, and they, if you think about it, actually they do quite a significant part of the job, because they're working with people. They're relating to people, they're speaking about values, they're speaking about friendship, they're speaking about doing good for the other, okay? So if you put all those things that are being done, and quite successfully, into a context of practical resilience, okay, to stand up to future disruptions, I think you can get a very, very high yield from this kind of an approach.
You also mentioned, though, in your article that intelligence is a part of this, and that's where you spent most of your first career was in that world. And intelligence is normally understood as being a top down, in our case, federal government level kind of thing.
Absolutely.
How does that play into this?
It plays into the resistance concept. No,
okay.
It doesn't play. It doesn't play with into the context of the resilience issues that I was talking.
Okay.
As I said before, I see resistance is a very important component of the struggle against terror and to do away with our threats, but mostly it has to do with the resistance domain and not with the resilience one, except for one thing that might be very interesting, but I'm not sure that we're doing much about it.
Okay.
And that is the following. I think we spoke before about the prospects that higher resilience would impact the willing or the determination of terrorists to launch terror against our community.
The idea being that we might deter them from acting if wouldn't produce any results.
So if intelligence would be geared to understand, know, and understand and implement a strategy of covering this particular issue of what can be the effects of our resilience on the willingness of terrorists to do us harm, this might be something that they don't do now, by the way. They don't do it. And because they naturally look only at the risky side of it,
yeah,
and not at the opportunities that it can be.
Opportunity analysis, at least in the U.S. intelligence, has been out there for a long time, but is always neglected.
Exactly. It's the same in Israel, unfortunately. Yeah.
So one of the immediate responses after September 11th, 2001 in the United States was to create this system of state and local fusion centers, mm-hmm, which was to tie in, state and local police, law enforcement, emergency responders, ultimately to the federal government, to the FBI and the CIA and all of this. So I don't want to put words in your mouth, but would you say, given your emphasis on bottom up,
uh-huh,
that that was a nice thing to do and probably helpful, but maybe not where you would have started after 9/11 if you were president or running things here in the United States?
Correct. I think that it has to be done. It has also to be, it has to be enhanced, improved, no doubt about that, because communication between different organizations on the upper level is very, very significant, but that's not where I would put most of my dollars, okay? As you suggested correctly, I think that when we talk about the aspects of different aspects of resilience as a response strategy, it has to go down to the communities themselves, and here again, very important question is how the firefighters, the first responders, etc., the police, are connected, number one, in between themselves, which is an issue by itself,
yes,
but not less than that, even more important than that, how they are connected to the, to their own community, which, by the way, is important also, very significant, in daily life. So actually you are doing something not solely for the sake of enhancing your preparedness to major disruptions, but what you have to do is to understand that it's all those things that I'm talking about, the bonding thing, the bridging thing, the social activity, etc., and the, you know, the infusion of the first responders into the local community is very, very important for everyday life.
So if my house is on fire or a bridge collapses or the, you know, a water main breaks or something like that, that the system works better because it's prepared for these bigger things, it also works better on the small things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then you have to remember one last thing in this respect. You know that 97 or 98% of the people who are being rescued, when there is a disruption, there is, you know, a catastrophe, okay, 95, more than 95%, 97% of the people that can be rescued are being rescued by their fellow neighbors and family members, okay? And only 3-4, maybe sometimes 5% of them are being rescued by the first responders.
That's remarkable. I had no idea.
Oh, yeah. But it's all over the world. It's the same thing. I mean, we have a major thing in Nepal or in Haiti or wherever, okay? Most of the people, I mean, as I said, close to 100% of them are being rescued by their neighbors. So, again, it goes back to the question of what is the association between people. So if there is a problem, you just run away, it's one thing. But if there is a problem, you run to help the others because you have been nurtured throughout the years since you were a kid to look for helping for the other, then of course it will be practiced in different ways.
Can we make any generalizations about what kinds of countries are more or less resilient? So for instance, are democracies better at this than authoritarian states? Are culturally, ethnically homogeneous countries better at it than, you know, more diverse countries? I don't know if you've looked at any of these questions. I don't want to put you on the spot here. But
Yeah. Well, let me put it this way. First of all, as I said before, I think the human race is quite resilient to begin with, number one. Number two, I'll try to give some general characteristics, but it's really quite tricky. I mean, it's not a yes or no kind of an answer. I would say the following. Basically, I think that yes, democracies are more resilient than authoritarian states, and the reason for that is that the people believe, I think rightfully so, that they have more freedom to communicate, to express their opinions, and also they have more trust in their leaderships. Okay, I'm not saying that they have trust, but more trust in their leaderships. By the way, we found out that trust in your leadership is extremely important, but it usually manifests itself in the local echelons more than in the national.
So I was going to ask about that, because in the United States, at least, both on the left and on the right, there are large percentages of the American population that look at the federal government as the enemy. But you're saying really more important is how do they feel about their city or county or state government.
Absolutely. In terms of resilience, absolutely, absolutely. So this is one thing I said. So I would say yes, this is my inclination to suggest, yes, democracies would be more resilient than non-democratic countries, number one. And then I would also say something, again, in terms of generalization, that affluent societies or well-to-do societies or solidly, not necessarily prosperous, but well-to-do countries or societies will be more resilient than those that are not. We've seen that time and again, and it's very interesting. If you are very poor, then you are less resilient. Your capacities to control your own destiny is less than those who have more confidence in themselves, organizing themselves to times of peril. Okay, so you have to be a little bit more hopeful. You have to be a little bit more confident with yourself. And if you are not, if you are very poor, despair, I would say, is the thing that leads you more than hope.
Well, so that leads me to the last point I wanted to discuss with you. It seems to me that a good bit of this is ultimately about psychology,
it
about
is.
How...
Social positive psychology is the name of the game.
How individual human beings are, how afraid are they, how do they respond to stress and, and catastrophe?
Yes. As a matter of fact, you know, present theories of societal resilience spring from clinical psychology, definitely. And as a matter of fact, the you know the science of psychology was very active in research about individual resiliency for years before we started to examine societal resilience. So absolutely, yes, we are definitely basing our research and our methodologies on things that have been done by psychologists years ago.
So that leads me then directly to my last question is, how resilient is resilience in or resiliency in the sense that it seems to me that potentially it would be vulnerable to political demagogues who see, you know, political advantage in making people afraid of the terrorists or the other, in whoever or whatever the other is. If you can get elected by pointing up the terrorist threat and pointing out that the terrorists can attack you in your home, on the bus, in the mall, at your workplace, kill your children at school, you know, you are never going to be safe. Couldn't that either prevent the creation of resilience or the flourishing of resilience or tear it down when it does exist?
I think, definitely I think so. I agree with you completely. I think that...
I was hoping you'd have a cheerier answer than that.
No. But let me tell you something. I mean, first of all, I think we have to be open. We have to have to, as I said before, we have to have control on our own life. And being scared and hysteria is not a strategy. And being afraid, period, it doesn't help us. I mean, we have to be concerned, of course. We have to understand. We have to be aware of the risks. Yeah, absolutely. But we have to understand that we are not really very close to a catastrophe. In this respect, especially when we talk about terror, etc., and we already referred to that beforehand. So I'm very much concerned with the demagogic kind of expressions from leaders all over the world, and I think they don't help us. I think they do us harm. And at the same time, I think that we are resilient enough to stand up to this kind of a disruption.
Well, Meir Elron, I could pester you for a long time. This has been such an interesting conversation, but I will not inflict that on you, and just want to thank you so much for sitting down and sharing your thoughts with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Global Security Podcast from Johns Hopkins University. For information about our part-time graduate programs, go online to advanced.jhu.edu. We hope you'll join us next time.